podcasting them softly this week. I am very, very excited to have my guest. You'll know him via his Stephen King adaptations, Master of Horror, Amazing Stories, FearNet, Trailers from Hell. He's also responsible for films such as Fuzzbucket, Critters 2, Psycho 4, the writer of The Fly 2, Batteries Not Included, Hocus Pocus, Michael Jackson's Ghost. He was a zombie and thriller. He was the unaccredited voice of a critter. He is writer, director, producer, and fellow podcaster. I'm very, very pleased at long last to welcome Nick Garris. Nick, thank you for being on Podcasting Softly.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. Boy, that list of credits is way too long. We've got to shorten that IMDb page.
I read there that you and your wife were both zombies in Thriller. You didn't happen to meet during Thriller, did you?
No, actually, we'd known each other before that. We'd been married before that.
Oh, okay.
But yes, we were both looking about like we look now, 30-some years ago. No. She still looks great. I look like I do in Thriller.
I thought that would have been such a great love story, like you both met as zombies on the making of Thriller. Would have been a beautiful story.
Sorry to disappoint.
That's okay. No, that's wonderful anyway. So, Mick, after a long, you're a busy man trying to get to talk to you, thanks very much for giving us your time this morning. In going through your numerous credits, the one thing that stands out with the podcasting that you do with Postmortem, and also some of your early credit relating to the makings of certain films like The Thing and such, it's obvious that aside from being a writer, director, and producer and all the wonderful things that you do, you still have maintained you're a great fan of film as well.
Well, I mean, that's the motivating factor. You either love movies or you don't.
And, yeah.
And this particular genre, I've been lucky enough, a lot of people consider it a ghetto. And it would be nice to work outside of the genre occasionally, which I've once in a while gotten the chance to do. But it's something I've always loved. I've always been inquisitive. And, even when I was in high school, was doing interviews with musicians that fascinated me. And just discovering the creative process and how different people approach it has always fascinated me. So, yeah, I'm a fan and I'm a curious fan. I love everything about making movies.
Yeah. I mean, I only bring it up, and I know, obviously, you don't go into making movies unless you love movies. But just the fact that watch probably like yourself a lot of interviews with directors and such, and some of them don't seem like they're having such a good time. Some of them don't seem terribly enthusiastic or seem to have a great enthusiasm for what they do. They seem kind of laborious. But then again,
because the hours are really long, or they were uncomfortable talking about it. But the people who I've met in this business, if you have any longevity in it at all, you have to love it, because the hours are crushing. A 12-hour day is a relatively short day on a film or television set, and it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So unless, even if you're Steven Spielberg or somebody who can do whatever he wants when he wants, the hours are long, it's very demanding. You're on like location away from home for months at a time. If you don't love it, you're a masochist.
Yeah. is there anyone that, I guess, because you yourself have interviewed quite a number of illustrious filmmakers. Some, sad to say, I was looking at your website again the other night and listening to some of your other interviews. Sadly, some of the people you have interviewed have passed away since. Is there any filmmakers that you admire that are still around, or that you may have missed out getting to talk to that you would have liked to?
I would love to have been able to talk to George Romero. I mean, we were friends, but I never interviewed him.
Right.
Toby Hooper and Robert were very close friends, and I interviewed him a couple of times.
Yeah.
Certainly there are plenty of other people that I want to talk to. And the podcast is now about to start its second season.
Yeah.
We'll start recording new interviews within the next couple of weeks. But I'm just fascinated by anyone who makes their living as a filmmaker, or even different parts of filmmaking, composers, who do the soundtracks, or actors or writers, and but people who have a list of credits that impress us, you know, that people who've made movies that are lasting, you know. It's the thought process. Directors don't work together, so it's really fascinating to talk to other directors and get insight into how they make their creations.
Right,
so, yeah, there are a lot of people out there I would love to talk to who I haven't yet and who I will, or I won't, but, you know, we'll have a bunch of new people.
That's cool. So any sort of big exciting guests that you can let us in on that you're having on Postmortem this season?
Well, you know, we haven't recorded any of them
yet,
and I don't want to get myself in trouble. There are people who... I've had several great people whom I've never interviewed before who have agreed to do the show, but we haven't been able to lock them in yet. So until they're recorded, I'm not in.
Okay. I'm kind of the same way.
Paul Carter. Yeah, you should know.
Yeah.
You should know the feeling.
Yeah. I'm kind of the same way. Until I've got, like, you know, the thumbs up and, you know, it's locked in the diary, I don't sort of brag too much. It's usually after the fact. Because sometimes you just don't know which way it's going to go. But you're grateful.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these guys are friends, and it's easy to set up. And some of them are really close friends, and it's not easy to set up. Or people like, you know, I've interviewed William Friedkin a couple of times, once 30-some years ago, and then again a few years ago on the Postmortem TV show. He wasn't somebody I knew before, but he was a great interview, and sometimes those are the most revealing, because I don't know anything about who they are or how they work and what their process is, and I learn a lot by, you know, he was a particularly interesting one, because he just didn't give a shit. You know, he would say what he wanted to say, and he was completely open and frank in a really compelling and fascinating way. And it's one of my favorite ones.
They're my favorite ones, too. I mean, often it's I guess you've encountered it, too. It's kind of a roll of the dice. Some people are very guarded, obviously political, with their responses. And some just, come hell or high water, they're just going to say whatever they think. And usually they're the...
Right.
I'm not saying that, you know, it's boring or less interesting the other way around, but I'm just saying the ones that are kind of free with their opinions tend to be the the more interesting.
Yeah. I still tend to feel there's a way to be free with your opinion and be circumspect.
and still be respectful too. I mean, you can say what you want within reason, but you know, as long as you're not being disparaging or anything like that in certain regards.
Yeah, and Friedkin and John Landis are really wonderful unfiltered. They're really great. Landis is a guy I've known. Landis since 1977.
Wow. Yeah.
We've been friends since then, and he'll still surprise me. Every time I see him, there'll be something wonderful and surprising come out of his mouth.
Yeah, I've seen your interviews with him. He actually was sort of one of the main sort of stars of this. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It was an Australian-made documentary called Machete Maidens Unleashed.
I love it.
Yeah.
I think Mark Hartley. I love what Mark does.
Yeah, his documentaries are really not quite Hollywood has become very much not just a documentary but kind of a social document almost for Australians.
I agree. I think his documentaries are great, and I think his version of Patrick is terrific as well.
Yeah, because it really, what that documentary essentially did was responsible in many ways for the re-release of many of the films included in that documentary. And also creating an awareness for that particular era that I think most people had forgotten.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was aware of some of those movies, but not most of them, as a guy who was born and raised in Los Angeles. So it was exciting for me to see it and to track down a lot of those movies.
Yeah.
You know, Brian Trenchard-Smith is one of the people who was pretty well chronicled in the film. And he and I became friends, and I brought him on as a director on a series that Steven Spielberg secretly produced called The Others.
Right.
And so Brian and I got to, and I learned a lot about his resume from those book discussions.
Yeah. And of course you and Brian have been regulars on Trailers from Hell too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That was something that Joe Dante created and turned into quite a wonderful little collection of some pretty priceless guruism.
It is a great little series. I always love checking it out. I guess, you know, to talk about you, most people know you because you've done quite a few adaptations of Stephen King's material. From, Sleepwalkers to The Stand, The Shining.
Yeah, we've done quite a few.
Yeah.
I think it's up to eight. With luck, we'll have another one in the offing.
Yeah, I remember watching The Stand when it was, because it was on television, and I remember when it came out, it was a great series. Those productions, like, for instance, like The Stand, The Shining, Bag of Bones, are they, like, I mean, you've directed features, are they more work, quite more elaborate production than just a feature film, are they?
Well, the feature films I've done have not been huge budget, you know, Marvel-sized feature films.
Right.
Sleepwalkers was a $15 million movie. Critters 2 was a $4 million movie. But The Stand was the first miniseries I did.
Right.
And it was, it's four movies, basically,
for
8 1-hour TV shows.
Right.
And that, we spent 2 months prepping it, 5 months shooting it, 5 months in post-production in New York. So I was away from home for a year making that.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, a lot of people on big movies, they'll spend a year making a big movie, but this was like making four movies in that year, and definitely the hardest I've ever worked. But I've been able to work in high-end television and not so high-end feature films, so it's hard to compare them because I've not had the luxury of a $200 million budget.
Right.
It's relatively common in the studio world these days.
Yeah.
But yeah, they are a lot of work, and especially as someone who, when I got into television, was not a guy who watched a lot of network TV.
Right.
But I loved movies, and I figured there wasn't really a difference between making films and making television other than the schedule and the budget.
Right.
So, television, before The Stand, most television was basically done in close-ups and master shots in a very non-cinematic style because people thought, you know, you're watching it on a smaller screen, you need those close-ups. But to me, most people they see most of their movies on television, so what's the difference? So I never really bought into that formula. And now TV is more cinematic than the movies these days.
Yeah.
It's exciting to see technology and delivery systems and you know, to see Netflix and HBO and all these companies have such an impact on television that it's all become more competitive and more cinematic, and it's kind of exciting.
Right. I mean, you're probably the best person to answer this question. Do you feel that Stephen King's material lends itself better to the miniseries rather than the feature film?
Well, it depends. You know, some of them, Riding the Bullet was a 30-page short story that we turned into a feature film where I added probably at least half of the material, making it original. The book, certainly, like The Stand, I mean, that was very well served as a miniseries.
Mm.
Under the Dome was turned into a regular series as opposed to a miniseries.
Right.
And I don't know that it sustained all the way through it, but, you know, it had the time to tell it. King liked to refer to it when we were making The Stand. He was excited by novels for television
right.
as opposed to a miniseries TV show. And it depends. Stand By Me is such a great film. Misery is such a great film.
Mm.
Carrie is such a great film. There are tons of great feature films based on King work.
Mm.
There's shitty King film, and there's great King films. There's shitty TV King, and there's great TV King. So it really just depends on who's making it. And
right.
by that, I don't just mean the format. Is it made for television? Is it made for Netflix? Is it made for commercial TV? Is it made for a theatrical film?
Yeah.
And then it comes to who the elements are. So it's a flip of the coin.
Yeah. Did you like
a movie.
Sorry. Yeah, go on.
Yes, go ahead.
Did you like the new...
Did
you like the new version of It?
Sure. I thought it was great. I'm eager to see where it goes, the part two is. And, you know, it's a great book. And the movie has the feeling, even though it's not a blow-by-blow reproduction of the book. It maintains its essence really well.
Mm.
And it's definitely a familiar world to me because it is so Stephen King. But I thought Muschietti did a really good job with it.
Yeah. You did a version of The Shining, and I know that Stephen King has been, it's been publicized that he wasn't really happy with Kubrick adaptation.
Right.
How did you feel doing a version that was obviously closer to the source?
Well, I was quite naive. When I first saw The Shining, it was a couple of days before it came out at a screening at Warner Brothers, and it was the movie I was most looking forward to in my life. And I was resoundingly disappointed. Most people who read the book first were disappointed in the movie. And at the time that film came out, it got universally bad reviews. Now, I love it as a Kubrick film, but I don't think it's a good King adaptation. And for many people, maybe even most people, who cares if it's a good King adaptation or not if you like the movie? And that's fair. But for me, as such a passionate lover of that book, I was really disappointed. I never knew that years later I would be doing a miniseries version. But King's dissatisfaction with that film led to the miniseries being made when The Stand was such a big success. And at the time, it was the most successful miniseries in history. ABC came back to him. Our ABC, not the Australian ABC, and said, "What do you want to make?" And he decided, "I'd love to do this band, The Shining." And so that's how it began. And with great naivete, I said, "Sure, I'd love to do it." And it was the best script I'd ever read in my life and offered to me.
Right.
But I got my first inkling of what I was stepping into when I talked to Gary Smith. Said, "Would you like to play Jack Torrance? We're going to be doing a miniseries." And he said, "You know, I'd be hesitant to step into Mr. Nicholson's shoes." And foolish me, I'd never thought of that before. But, you know, there were a lot of people who turned it down for that very reason. So we just forged ahead and nothing special.
Mm.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Somebody on another line.
But no, so that's, no, I've always been interested about it because the ones that you have directed, Stephen King has written the adaptations of his own work. So
most
obviously,
of them, yeah.
Obviously
yeah.
He's as impressive a screenwriter as he is a novelist.
Well, interestingly, you know, he had kind of a revelation during the making of The Stand. Now, The Stand was a 460-page script,
right,
which can be kind of overwhelming when it's delivered to your home, bigger than three phone books. But during the making of The Stand, you know, I was really, really taking it seriously and committed to making it something that would not disappoint the people who love the book because it was his most successful book. And during the making of that, he said to me, "You know, I never really respected the screenwriting process as much as writing books. I didn't think they were the same thing until The Stand, where I realized this is respectable. I used to think that it was a lesser art to write a screenplay was less important to it at that time. But during the making of The Stand, I think he really had kind of a revelation and a transition when it came to his respect for the screenwriting form. And like I said, the next thing we did together was The Shining.
Right.
And I've never read such a good script.
Yeah. Another great series that you were a part of that I was a massive fan of when it was on was Amazing Stories. How did you come to work on Amazing Stories?
Amazing Stories was my first real job as a screenwriter. I had been hired to write a script once before, but nothing ever became of it. So I was doing an interview show on a local pay TV channel before there was an HBO or Showtime in Los Angeles. And I managed to get Steven Spielberg as a guest. And so then I got a job doing special genre publicity at Universal the year they were making The Thing and E.T. and American Werewolf in London and Videodrome 81-82. And Stephen remembered me from the Z Channel show that I did. That interview, by the way, is on the Vic Garris Interviews TV6.com website with a bunch of the other TV6. And so I was hired to do the making of the Goonies documentary. And we were on location up in Oregon. And it was the first day of shooting, and I was setting up to interview Steven. And he said, you know, you must do a lot of these making of documentaries. And I had done a few, and I said, I can't believe I said this, but because I had known him for several years off and on, I said, yeah, I am, but I'm trying to put all of my concentration into my writing. Oh, you're a writer? Yeah. I've been working on that for years. And he said, well, you know, we're looking for writers for this new TV series called Amazing Stories. And my agent had submitted a sample of my work to them. And I said, yeah, I just heard about that, and I hear that your people are reading something of mine. So it turned out later that they really liked the script they'd read, and Kathy Kennedy called me and asked me if I would come in and meet with Stephen, and then Stephen called and said he wanted to talk and wanted me to write an episode for this new show, and I found out years later that I was the first one he asked to write one. So I spent 3 days writing.
Wow.
Spent 3 days writing it, turned it in, and they really liked it and asked me to do another one right away. So a day and a half into the writing, Stephen called me again and said they would like to offer me a full-time job as the story editor on the series.
Wow.
So I was like, holy shit. And I was on food stamps at the time, welfare at the time, not being able to make meat, trying to make a go of it as a writer or doing publicity or making up documentaries and things.
Yeah.
And that's how that happened, and it changed my life, and I've been working ever since.
Wow. Because that was a fantastic series. It was just, yeah.
It was up and down.
Yeah,
great ones.
There were some really great ones, and like you say, sort of mediocre. But yeah, there hasn't really been anything like that since that type.
Well, not of that, but the anthology certainly has had a lot of exercise over the years. But never where you'd get an animated one day, you'd get a family fantasy comedy 1 week, and then the next week would be a serial killer thriller and. It just was all over the place. And now Apple is making a reboot of Amazing Stories.
Wow, yeah.
Brian Fuller running.
Yeah.
So that, with luck, maybe we'll end up... I would love to be able to do one for them.
That'd be great. Yeah, get some of the original... The original writers back, yeah. Critters 2 is one of my favorite movies. I was very curious where they would go after the first one, but the second one is just what you'd expect. It's Critters, but it's a whole lot of fun. One of my favorite lines in movies ever comes from Critters 2, and that's the line about cheeseburgers, no bones. How he gets him to lure to lure the other ones back. Can you tell me about the the good oil on Critters 2?
It was my first feature film as a director. I had been working for Steven Spielberg as a writer primarily, and then I had directed one of the episodes of Amazing Stories. But there were a lot of things coming in for me to potentially direct or to meet on that were, lots of visual effects and stunts and all these things, and I thought, God, this is kind of overwhelming. Am I ready for this? And they were not greenlit movies. They were just, if we make this, would you be interested? And you go through that kind of dance for a while. But they actually came to me with that and said, we're going to make this. We want you to direct it. You can rewrite it however you like. Do you want to? And so it was my first real greenlit offer on the table as a director after I had directed an episode of Amazing Story. And so I went for it. And, of course, it was visual effects. It was kids. It was stunts. It was a big cast. agent work, and all in for $4 million. So it was a very difficult but really fun movie to make. It happened during the coldest winter in 100 years in Southern California.
Wow.
And so, you know, the scene where the bounty hunter turns into the beautiful Playboy playmate, where she's stomping naked through the field.
Yeah.
It was 22 degrees.
Wow.
22 degrees Fahrenheit.
Goodness.
So that must have been, what's that, minus 5 or something.
Well,
and, it was a great experience.
Yeah.
I was allowed to rewrite it the way I liked. David Toohey had written a really good script that was kind of an old-fashioned Western.
Right.
With a sense of humor and with furballs with big teeth and a big appetite. And it had a lot of humor, and to this day, it's one of only two comedies I've ever made. So,
yeah.
This is its 30th anniversary, by the way, 1988.
Yeah, I know. That's fantastic. Yeah, well, all credit to that actress then for that day for putting a brave face on it.
Roxanne Kernahan was her name, and she was great, and several years later, she unfortunately passed away in a car accident.
Yeah, no, that's terrible. But it's a marvelous film. I don't know. I love the blend of comedy and horror. I think it's a I think it's something that's when it's done right it's really good, and when it's done badly it's not too bad either.
Well, comedy horror is a hard balance to make. So many of them, you know, horror comedies that aren't funny or scary, and it's a tough tightrope to walk. But we had a bunch of great people involved in that. You know, the director of photography, Russell Carpenter, went on to win the Oscar for Titanic.
Yeah.
You know, Barry Corbin as the sheriff was amazing. Did such great work in No Country for Old Men, things like that. Lynn Shay, of course. And the Kyoto brothers and their creatures, the critters themselves, all of that stuff. We really had a great team.
And also your co-writer David Toohey, he went on to do some pretty cool stuff as well. I like his science fiction movies. The Riddick movies aren't too bad.
Yeah, no, he did a bunch of really good stuff as writer and director.
Yeah.
So we never actually got to work together. He
The
first draft.
All right. Okay. Right.
And
so
then here's how you can tell when you're looking in the credits. If there's an ampersand between the names, it means they worked as a team.
Oh, okay.
If and is spelled out between the names, it means they weren't separate.
Oh, okay. All right. So
here's your Hollywood.
All right, okay. So he had already turned in a script, and then you came on after the fact.
Exactly.
All right. So you got to that was Critters 2. You also did another sequel to a successful horror film, which was The Fly 2, as well.
Yeah, that was I was mostly a screenwriter at that time.
Right.
And so Fly 2 came about. You know, I was a huge fan of David Cronenberg's film, and I'd worked with David and known David. I did publicity on The Scanners and did the making of Videodrome and some other things. And it came along, and David was one of the people who recommended me for the sequel. And it turned out that it worked out. I was hired to do it. I had an original concept that they quickly threw out and said they wanted to make a teenage monster. So I was in the middle of reworking that, and I'd done two or three drafts, and it was very frustrating when the offer to do Critters 2 came to direct my first movie. And so after I finished up my obligations on that, because there were fights between the head of the studio and Scott Rudin, who was the studio executive assigned to the film. They had a new head of the studio, Leonard Goldberg, and they did not agree at all on what the movie was they were going to make. So it was good timing for me to get the offer to do Critters.
Right.
Yeah, that time is when I left to do Critters 2.
Oh, okay.
All right. The there, and they wanted to turn it into a teenage monster movie, and
right.
not really the kind of movie I was looking to do at the time.
Okay.
So I moved.
Yeah, I have to say, of the Fly 2, I haven't lost my lunch over many films, but that was one of the movies I did. Yeah, I did. My lunch came back on me, and it was not one of the particular gory moments. It was just the moment when it's at the end when he goes through the pods and is turned back into a human form, and he's covered in like the goo, and she kind of just, she doesn't really wipe it away. Daphne Zuniga doesn't wipe it away to kiss him, and she just kind of like plants one on him, and he's covered in like this stuff. And I don't know what it was about that just, I was like, oh God, you could have wiped his face or something. And I just went, oh, and yeah, got up and excused myself, and yeah, I thought,
bring me a bowl.
Yeah, I could have like, oh, she could have just wiped his face or something with her shirt or.
Well, give all the credit to Chris Whalen, the director, on that. He was the makeup effects guy on The Fly, and then became the director on the sequel.
Yeah, because it was, I have vivid recollections of that.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. I know it's not your fault, but...
Okay, I'm not really sorry at all.
Another film that you did some writing on, and I'd be remiss not to talk because I know that my wife really enjoys the film, is Hocus Pocus.
Everybody's wife seems to love Hocus Pocus.
Really?
It's interesting what a great female following it has. I'm sure because it's got such a strong female cast.
Right.
But that was something that came up while I was working on Amazing Stories. Producer had the idea for the movie. His name was David Kirshner, and he was a really talented artist, and also created the Chucky and An American Tale, the animated movie that Steven Spielberg produced.
Right.
So between me working for Spielberg and him hoping to make this a Spielberg production, he brought me on board to be the first writer on it, and then we pitched it to Steven Spielberg together, and Spielberg, once he found out Disney was involved, at that time Amblin and Disney were deep competitors, so it was like, oh, no, we're not going to do it. If Disney's going to do it, you don't need us. So, but I was the first writer on that, and it was much darker when I was working on it.
Okay.
Not quite as funny. The biggest change that was made, there were another 11 writers on it after me. It got made 8 years after I wrote my versions. But I basically wrote it about 12-year-olds, and they made a movie about 16-year-olds. But structurally and everything else, it's pretty very similar to what I did.
Right.
A little funnier and a little more...
Okay.
A lot of changes take place behind the scenes.
Yeah, I imagine. As a director that's primarily associated with the horror genre, having sort of come through the 80s and 90s, how do you feel about the modern wave of horror films?
Well, I think it's great because I think there's more variety to it than ever. The studios still see them as teenage movies, but all around the world and in the independent world, it seems they realize that the best genre films are made for adults and not made to be franchises. You know, there's a great history of Australian horror films, European, South Korea and Spain are particularly great. And one of the things about having had a career in this genre is that I've been invited to a lot of festivals around the world, and I get exposed to movies that I wouldn't otherwise see in a multiplex in L.A. So I think it's incredibly exciting that people are bringing new ideas to movies and not just doing the same old, same old. It's not Friday the 13th, Part 37. But, you know, there are a lot of visionaries working in the field, and and I love to see that. And I think it's the genre that is the most cinematically exciting of all.
Mm.
It needs to be good drama to work, first of all. And then on top of that, it needs to touch a place in you that affects you in a very visceral sense.
Yeah.
Fear, anxiety, you know, those things. You know, it's easy to make a movie that's just throwing splat up on the screen.
Mm.
But to disturb the audience in a way that you take home with you after the credits roll, that's pretty amazing. And you can only really do that if there's good drama at the center of it. If you've got characters in an involving story that you can believe and identify with, then you're way ahead of the game. And I think it's happening more than ever right now.
Mm.
And it's been exciting to be making films.
Mm.
Not a very profitable time for an independent filmmaker because of the way films are distributed now. It's really difficult for somebody to actually make a living making genre films,
yeah.
Independent genres. You can make them for next to nothing, but that's what they're worth in the world of online distribution.
So yeah.
It's a rough road home.
Yeah, no, the game is... The game is changing and ever evolving, but I agree with you as far as what you were saying about horror. I think it's really prevalent of any genre, and I think it's something that's lacking a little bit in some modern films. Is a compelling plot and characters aside from just spectacle. You know, once said of King's work that, and I firmly believe it, that he is one of the best writers of characterization that there is. And really, you get to fully assimilate with these characters, and then he brings in the, whether it be a supernatural element or the horror element. And
absolutely. No, yeah. I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah.
He, first of all, tells a ripping story.
Yeah.
But sets it in a world that we all live in and that we're all familiar with and that we know. And that's his strength, is his voice. And, I will never cease my admiration for his talents.
Yeah.
He's an amazing human being as well as an amazing artist.
Yeah. But I think that's something that's kind of lost. I mean, you go to the cinema lately and you watch these very visually impressive films, but where they come up short, I feel, is in the areas of plot and character, because you really, when stuff starts to happen to the characters, there's really no one you're invested in, because they're not really well drawn. They're kind of just cardboard cutouts of a sort.
Yeah. Well, sort of the big studio movies. These days are more like a video game or a theme park ride than they are a story.
Yes.
And it's about the spectacle. And I understand that. You want to pull people out of their homes with with something that is an event that you go to the cinema to see, and you'll pay the cinema prices to see it. It's in 3D and all that. But, I'd much rather just see something captivating with people, with characters that are like, wow, this is an interesting take. I totally believe who these people are.
Mm.
I knew a guy like that.
Mm.
But then with ideas, I want people to have better ideas than me and think of things that I wouldn't think of. So I'm watching a movie and these outrageous things happen, but I totally accept them happening because they're crafted so well.
Yeah. Yeah. But in the absence of that, you can just be like me and hang out at home and watch Critters 2 with a bowl of popcorn and have a really good time.
There you go.
Anyway, Mick, look, you've been very generous with your time this morning or this afternoon, where you are. It has been an absolute pleasure to finally get to chat with you. We've come close several times over the length, but we've finally got there. It's been a real treat from one podcast to another. I'm looking forward to the new series of Postmortem and everything else that you've got going. You're a very busy man. I know you've got a lot of fingers in a lot of pies. I can't wait to taste a slice of each of them. Mick Garris, thank you.
Well, all right. Thank you, Kent. Great talking to you.
Thank you for being on Podcasting Softly, and keep up all the good work, eh?
We'll try. Take care.
All right, mate. Cheers. Thank you.